anybody have any questions or comments about our weather situation? Is there anything you've always wondered about that I haven't discussed?
It just explains why the weatherman is in the West Coast is so excited about everything.
Yeah, well, you know, that animation is what draws in the viewers and sells the ads. I'm excited.
Richard?
Yes.
One of the things that's really fun about this area right here is it's kind of right on the cusp.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So when you hike the trails here, just changing aspect will change plant community and everything, kind of west side and east side.
I'm glad you said that.
It's really neat.
Yeah, it is true. We're in a transition zone, and one nice thing about that, this kind of transition between one ecosystem and the next, is something that ecologists have invented a special word for. Ecologists have invented more peculiar words to describe their discipline than practically any other. And partly that was because one of the first ecologists, a fellow from Nebraska, by the way, named George Clemens, was also something of a philologist or word lover. And I think his wife, too, was a Latin teacher. And so he has a whole collection of words that actually have sort of fallen out of fashion. The Europeans don't use them, and, you know, we go to international conferences, and what? But this is a good word everybody uses. It's called ecotone. And it's the boundary between one habitat and the next. Well, say you've got 200 species of plants that grow in this one, and you've got, we'll just say 80 species of plants that grow in this one. In this ecotone, which is the band between the two, you might have actually something greater than the sum of these two parts. You could have 300 species, because not only do you have species that will grow here, and those that will grow here, but also those adapted to this special niche of the overlap between the two. So ecotones are interesting, exciting places, both botanically and for wildlife. A lot of wildlife, they may nest here, but they forage here. So in that ecotone, things are sort of at the tipping point. And something that might seem relatively trivial under other circumstances can become crucial. An aspect, which Carol mentioned, is one of those. Aspect, when we say it, refers to which direction the sun is coming from. Slope refers to how steep the thing is that defines your aspect. If it's like this, basically you have zero slope, and aspect doesn't matter. Unless, of course, you've got a forest over here and a prairie over here. In that case, you're not going to plant your garden at this spot unless this faces south. So if you have the southern sun coming in here, maybe this would be okay. Maybe you want to put it right out in the middle anyhow, because you capture the most from all directions. But that's slope and aspect are two things that are very important. Slope, why would slope matter? Aside from the question of aspect, what else about slope could be important?
Drainage.
Yeah, exactly. Drainage, and if you have a very steep slope, at some point the slope becomes too steep, no matter how wet it is, for plants to take root. So everything is going to fall off. So gravity affects not just drainage, but it also affects the ability of things to take hold and hang on. So there's slope, and there's aspect, and then there's the parent material, the underlying stuff that things are going to grow in. And sometimes that very underlying material is enough to define an ecotone. Sometimes the principal factors, if you were going to name two things that made the most difference in where plants grow and consequently where all the things that rely on them live, any suggestions? Two factors. This is tough because, you know, if I said name 12, then...
Sun and moisture.
Well, sun is close.
Growing season.
Moisture is absolutely right. And actually, sun and growing season both speak to temperature. And I've seen graphs that show ecosystems that are based on the average annual temperature and the average annual precipitation. So up here, where things are hot and wet, or warm and wet, you're going to get a certain suite of species. Down here, where things are cold and dry, that could be an alpine zone, or it could be a high desert. You're going to get another collection of species. And these two factors are going to have more effect than any other things, all else being equal.
I want to ask you, now we live on Whidbey Island, and we have a lot of the same plants that you have here at this height, mm-hmm. which is amazing to me.
Yeah, Whidbey, I know Whidbey Island, and I know the grasslands out there, Peavey's Landing and some of the other places at Whidbey and Deception Pass. This is like a family conversation for those of you who don't know.
Well, it's strange because we're so high here and it's just about at sea level there, that's right.
Yeah, well, there are some plants that have what's called wide ecological amplitude. That is, yarrow is an example. Yarrow is a plant that some people grow in their gardens. There are cultivated varieties of yarrow that are different colors. How many people are familiar with yarrow? Yeah, so it's a fairly common garden plant. It's also a fairly common weedy species. It is native here, but there are non-native yarrows that have been brought in and have spread. Generally, if you're up in an alpine area or, you know, a mountainous area that doesn't have many, if any, non-native plants, the yarrow you see is going to be a native. If you're down in a schoolyard or a field that's full of weeds and you see yarrow, it's probably not native. But they are basically the same species. They just got their genes from another part of the world. But yarrow has broad ecological amplitude. In fact, yarrow is a good example of ecotypes. You have plants that may be the same species and maybe are interfertile. That is, you can fertilize one of them with pollen from another, but their growth is quite different depending on where they grew up, what kind of selection pressures were underway and affecting their growth. And there's an Achillea. That's a yarrow, the scientific name. Achillea borealis, which basically just means northern yarrow. It's called Achillea, by the way, named after Achilles, the hero of the Trojan War, because supposedly he used it to help stanch the bleeding of his comrades in arms. Achillea does have medicinal properties, and it is used as an astringent and to help stop bleeding. And it's also very, very pungent. If you crush a leaf and smell it, it has kind of a sagey smell. But that's another story. I digress. There, Achillea borealis that is collected in Alaska, for example, might grow that high. And Achillea gregorialis that comes from California could be like that, actually, you know, a fairly robust thing. And these are feathery leaves. And even if they're grown in the same place, in a transplant garden, this was actually done at Stanford back in the 40s. Two plants, identical species, but not identical ecotypes. This one was adapted to the conditions in Alaska, where it needed to stay low to the ground in order to protect itself from freezing. And this was basking in the warmth of the California sun and took full advantage of it, grew up and grew as large as it was capable of growing. But then seed from this one and seed from this one went into a transplant garden in the same spot, and they came out looking like they did in their natural habitat. So ecotones have a big influence on not just which plants, but also they can influence the peculiar or specific characters of the plants of a given species.
Did they do that several generations down so that they, you know, did they eventually equal out, or did they remain true to that through subsequent?
Well, that's a good question, and it would be an interesting study, and I'm sure somebody has done it, but I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I should talk about soils at this point. Any other questions about what I've brought up so far? Okay, soils are a product of five factors, principally. When I took my first soils class, my mnemonic was clip rot. That's for climate. Parent material, relief basically is slope or topography, organic activity, and time. The type of soil that we have around here is influenced by glacial activity. It's also heavily influenced by parent material and by relief. There's a lot of bare soil around here. There's not deep deposits of glacial till. All that stuff is farther down in the lowlands. In fact, Lake Chelan, which I assume everybody floated up on to get here, was carved out by a glacier, and at the southern end was plugged up by the southern terminus of that glacier. So we're right here close to the edge of glaciation from the last pulse of the last ice age. Actually, we may still be in the last ice age. We don't know. There could be another pulse in a few thousand years. But we flatter ourselves to think that there's something unique about the time in which we are alive, and so we say, well, the ice age just ended 10,000 years ago, and then we came along. And the parent material we have around here, well, a lot of it is nice, and granite. And this stuff is quite resistant. It's going to break down slowly. Soils here are thin for a number of reasons. One is because of the durability of the parent material. The climate here acts somewhat in favor of creating deeper soils because there's so much freezing and thawing here. On a sunny day like this, up high, where the sun is shining for almost 16 hours, where the cloud cover is nil on days when it is. When the radiation that reaches that height is extremely high, an awful lot of ultraviolet is coming in the thin air. There's a tremendous amount of absorption of solar energy, and that causes rocks to warm up and expand, and then you get a cold night in the mountains. It's always cold at night. For the same reason, the thin air, there's no blankets over the earth. And you could have freezing. You'd have freezing in the summertime.
That's the helicopter that rescued Pete last week.
Oh.
I was telling the story. So. It was going to buzz us today.
So all that
Sorry,
freezing. No, that's fine. That's fine. It's the helicopter interrupted me. All of that freezing and thawing actually has tended to, except for the stratovolcanoes, the really tall ones that are being pushed up all the time, has tended to level off our highest peaks. If you go out and look out through the North Cascades, you're going to see that things top out at generally 8,000 or 9,000 feet. And a lot of that is just because they get so high, and then they get into a zone where the freezing and thawing, it's busting the rock up, and it's tumbling down. So, you know, there's a Japanese saying that any nail that sticks up will be hammered down. And that's sort of what's happening in the North Cascades because of that alternate freezing and thawing. So the climate will tend to bust things up around here. At the same time, it does slow down organic activity more than it speeds it up. Things get hopping on a hot day, but a lot of creatures can't be active for much of the year, either because they're covered by snow, it's just too darn cold, there's not enough light. Number of factors tend to inhibit the organic breakdown of soil. When I say organic activity, I'm talking about creatures great and small. From bacteria to elk, all of them play a role in helping to break down soil and also contribute material to the soil. From their waste products to nibbling up all the little bits, turning big bits into small bits, all of that is an important factor. Time, I probably don't need to expand on that issue. All of these things are going to accumulate over a period of time. And some very old soils have been severely weathered. Bauxite is aluminum ore, and bauxite is found in the tropics. They mine a lot of bauxite out of Jamaica, where it's hot and wet, it rains a lot, it's very warm, and what happens is that all kinds of minerals get leached out, and it leaves behind, or leaches down into a layer, all of the iron and aluminum. So that's a highly weathered soil. Tropical soils tend to be devoid of many of the nutrients that plants need, which is why when you clear-cut tropical rainforest, it never grows back. Because in a tropical rainforest, normally all of the nutrients, the carbon, the nitrogen, everything else that plants depend on, is just grabbed up the minute it hits the forest floor. So these things are recycled very quickly, and the competition for it is intense. Once you wipe out the forest, you just can't get that system back. It's a little different here. We can get it back. It just takes time. Yes?
I'm thinking of Mount St. Helens and the year after the tremendous crops that they had, for example, in the Columbia Basin, how fertile the soil became after that was thrown out. Is there any kind of, say, parent material that would affect fertility here because of volcanic activity, or did it miss this area?
Well, I'd say
I'm not talking about Mount St. Helens.
Right.
The volcanoes along the Cascades in general.
Right. Well, the volcanoes along the Cascades have contributed as well as detracted from the soil fertility around here. It's a contradictory thing. They are rich in phosphorus, and so in a soil that's affected by volcanism, plants don't have to go scrounging for that. The main competition among plants is for nitrogen, and the volcanoes don't contribute all that much in the way of nitrogen. They can enrich the soil, but they can, depending on the quality of the material that's ejected, they can also give you a completely sterilized soil. The pumice planes on the slopes of Mount St. Helens basically are puffed glass. It's just pure silica that's been shot full of air, and it's the most inhospitable environment imaginable. On the other hand, some of the ash that floated, drifted longer distances, finer material, might contain a lot of other things that are helpful. After the glaciers receded, or as they were receding, one of the greatest enhancers of soil fertility was all of the wind-blown material. Glaciers have something called katabatic winds. You have cold air. You've got the ice is standing higher than the rest of the topography. So you've got this big glacier that, say, it's a big wedge here, looked at from the side. And you've got all these rocks and sand washing out from this end, and really cold air, which comes rushing down and hits all of this stuff, and all of this debris and crushed rock and powdered rock, like the rock flour that you see in glacial streams, got hit by these winds and blown into the Palouse. And the Palouse soils are very deep. And they're what it's called, German word. Some people call it loess, some people call it loess. But that's very fertile soil, and very deep soil too. So it's you can't say absolutely that a volcanic soil is going to be fertile, but it often can be. It depends on where you are in relation to the volcano. So there's soils, and I know everybody is really most excited about the big animals, the charismatic megafauna, as conservationists call them. How many have heard that term before? Okay, well, it's a good one to know. It's it drives a lot of conservation activity. Calendars you get from the National Wildlife Foundation, they generally don't have pictures of snail darters on them. They have the charismatic megafauna. The snow leopard, Siberian tiger, African elephant, the bonobo chimpanzees, they're the ones that really draw the crowds. Just had a baby elephant born at the Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle, and they've been packing them in with that. And now we've got probably at the Center for Urban Horticulture and at the University of Washington, one-third of the world's population of showy stick seed, Achillea venusta, nobody's come to see it. Well, it is time to talk about production and consumption. I've got about 15 minutes left. Before I go on, I just want to encourage any questions or comments. Okay. There was a Dr. Wagner at the University of Michigan one of the world's leading experts in ferns. I actually heard him speak just 3 years ago. He has since died. But he was a wonderful scientist, a very learned man, and a terrific lecturer, industrious worker. He made tremendous contributions to science. And he would teach basic biology classes to undergraduates. That was one of the things he thought he ought to do as a research scientist and professor at a leading institution. He should have contact with undergrads on a regular basis, not just as a fluke. He defined biology as the study of plants and their predators. So it really does take in just about everything. And the reason he said that is that plants are the primary producers. There are some organisms that don't rely on energy from the sun. And they live on this planet. They don't rely on it even indirectly. They rely on other sources of energy, basically geothermal or geochemical. These organisms are iron bacteria, sulfur bacteria, certain kinds of tube worms. You know where they're found? Deep sea ocean vents. You knew that.
Yes.
You were going to say that, and I didn't give you a chance. But you know, really, our lives are not affected in a big way by tube worms and deep sea ocean vents. And neither are the lives of 99% of the organisms on this planet, or of their biomass. So, basically, we're talking about capturing solar energy and capturing that by converting carbon dioxide, which is not a very energetic molecule. Nobody burns carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is the product of burning. Converting carbon dioxide, you all know this. This is photosynthesis. Carbon dioxide and water. Oh, that was supposed to be a bolt of lightning. Symbolizing energy. Is going to turn out sugar. I'm not going to balance this equation. Nobody cares, am I right? Okay. Water plus carbon dioxide plus the input of energy from the sun gives us sugar through photosynthesis. And it is the carbon in this sugar that really drives all the life on Earth. Plants are just big solar arrays. The leaf of a plant is a solar energy panel. And it's taking that energy from the sun to boost the energy levels of a couple of electrons, which is necessary to convert. It does a couple of things. It splits this water molecule into oxygen and hydrogen. And it takes that energy needed to raise electrons to a level that they can be contributed to this carbon atom together with some of this H and O in order to make sugar. It's a process called reduction, the gaining an electron is called reduction. It doesn't sound intuitive, but take my word for it. We used to remember it in chemistry class by Leo the Lion says, "Grr." Loss of electron is oxidation. Gain of electron is reduction. Oxidation is burning. Respiration is a type of oxidation, actually. When you breathe, you are burning carbon and you're emitting carbon dioxide. What a plant does is just the opposite of that. It's reduction, and it's putting energy into something in the form of an energized electron. And out of that comes all life. Plants produce leaves and stems, and they are eaten directly by herbivores. Sometimes indirectly, the products of plants are siphoned off by fungi or by other parasitic plants. That's why you have some plants with no chlorophyll. There are such. They evolved from plants that did have chlorophyll, but they gradually lost it. In the case of fungi, they're not plants. They never had chlorophyll. In fact, fungi probably evolved before plants did. My botany department still has mycologists, people who know about fungi, together with botanists. But they're as different as the people over in the zoology building are from one another in terms of the kingdoms that they are responsible for. So the primary producers are the plants. And they're down at the bottom here. And then the next step up would be herbivores. And actually, there's a reduction in efficiency of the use of that solar energy at every step up the ladder. The reduction is maybe 30% or so. And as you go higher, it becomes less and less. That's why a top predator who's eating at this level really takes so much more of this, ultimately. That's why it's easier to feed the planet on grain than it is to grain and legumes. If you eat only grain, you're going to lose three essential amino acids. So you've got to combine them with legumes, and they complement one another. That's why you eat beans and rice. That's why you eat, well, you get my point. I've got 10 minutes left. All right, so you've got here the herbivores. And above the herbivores, carnivores. And you've got carnivores eating carnivores, too. So we don't know how many trophic levels we have here. Trophic has to do with eating food. But the top predators need big territories. They're generally large animals. They roam a wide range. Grizzly bears are not going to be content with it. Size of Holden Village, probably. We can fit. There used to be 600 miners living here. Well, we never had 600 grizzly bears living here. Now there are a lot of different relationships expressed among these different creatures. You've got parasitism. Mutualism. What else did I say I was going to tell you about? Symbiosis, of course. Some of these terms I think are going to be self-explanatory. Mutualism is different from symbiosis because it's not quite as tight a relationship. In symbiosis, you've got things that may have even co-evolved and live together. Mutualism is a relationship in which both benefit. There may be a relationship in which one thing benefits, but the other isn't hurt. And there's a special term for that, too. That's commensalism. You know, I've heard the term deep ecology. Is anybody else familiar with that idea of deep ecology? Well, for me, that's like the eye doctors getting together and talking about deep ophthalmology. You know, they don't talk about deep ophthalmology, just ophthalmology. They study eyes. They study them to the greatest detail and as much depth as they know how. The same thing is true of ecology. I think deep ecology is maybe used by people who are a little naive about what the science of ecology is all about. Ecology actually serves double duty because it is both a scientific discipline and it also describes, you know, the world in general. And what is an ecologist? Well, an ecologist can be somebody who writes papers that are published in the Journal of Ecology, or it can be somebody who goes out and helps to heal the earth and lobbies for certain kinds of legislation. But ecology basically talks about the functioning of organisms as communities in a broad sense through historical time, through geological time. Anyway, we got a whole lot of terms covering the subject of ecology. I took my watch off. I don't know why I did that. I put it in my pocket.
5 to 6.
We're pushing it. Okay. What I want to talk about is the relationships among species. And these things, symbiosis, a good example of symbiosis, and one that is actively functioning out here, occurs in the case of nitrogen. And I talked about how important nitrogen was. When you put fertilizer on your lawn, you have three numbers that come on the bag. N, P, K. And this is usually the biggest. That's nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. Sometimes the nitrogen will be in the form of ammonium nitrate. Well, ammonium is mostly nitrogen. Nitrate is mostly nitrogen, so you get a double dose of it in what becomes a soluble form that plants can take up. Nitrogen is in kind of the same situation as carbon. Plants are the things on this planet that can fix carbon. That is, they can take atmospheric carbon and convert it into mineral form, in sugar, which other things can assimilate. Well, same thing is true of nitrogen. The nitrogen in the atmosphere cannot be used by the plants until it's converted into mineral form. Then they can assimilate it. Then they can pull it in through their roots in solution. There's only one kind of organism. There are several different species of this kind of organism, but only bacteria can fix nitrogen. There's some special types of bacteria. Some of them are associated with legumes. If you ever pull up a pea plant or a Scots broom if you're weeding, you'll find these little pink bumps on the roots. Those are nodules that are formed by the symbiotic relationship between the rhizobium bacterium and the legume. All legumes have a relationship with rhizobium. And there are a number of different rhizobium species, and some of them are specific to particular legumes. But that's where they get their nitrogen, or that's one of the sources. They still absorb it through the roots, but they have an advantage over plants in a nitrogen-poor environment that cannot pull in their own. Alder trees have a relationship with a different kind of bacteria, and the same is true of a plant called Ceanothus, and we've got examples of it. I saw them along the road when we took our walk today. They use another bacterium called Frankia, does the same thing. But those are the only kinds of organisms on this planet that are able to take atmospheric nitrogen and put it into a form that plants can use. So between those two things, fixing nitrogen and fixing carbon, all the rest of the life on the planet dines at the table of these two broad categories of organisms. I think I better stop. I could go on. We didn't get into the issues of competition, which are really very interesting, but I'm talking again tomorrow, and tomorrow I'm really going to get into a subject that I know something about, which is plants. So if you're free to come tomorrow, I certainly welcome you. And if you have any time at this point to look at some rocks, I can tell you about them, but I don't want to hold anyone past the point where they think they're not going to get dinner. So,
does lightning fix nitrogen?
As a matter of fact, yes. Lightning is, and nitrogen also comes from volcanoes in mineral form. So it's true, there are natural processes that result in mineralized nitrogen. Physical processes. This is the only organic process that does it. But in some cases, it might be a fairly large contribution. Say, after a big volcanic eruption, there may be a lot of nitrogen in the form of nitrate that can reach plants that will take it up.
How did nitrogen fixation evolve? Story.
Well,
I know it's a subject for a whole course, probably.
But. Yeah. Basically, what the organisms that use these things, including the iron bacteria and sulfur bacteria, they're using nitrogen in the same way as an electron acceptor. It's with us. It's hemoglobin. When we respire, we are oxidizing carbon. And there has to be a complementary process to that. We have to have something that's going to carry that electron through a chain of chemical reactions until it ends up with its final acceptor. And in our case, it's iron, which is in hemoglobin. If you have iron poor blood, that means you're not producing enough hemoglobin because iron is a critical element in the hemoglobin molecule. And the same thing happens with bacteria, and it would be in an oxygen-poor environment, I would expect, because they need a substitute for what otherwise would serve that purpose. I can't give you a better answer than that.
Thank you very much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for staying awake. I don't. I know that there are a lot of people concerned about hormones as endocrine disruptors, mm-hmm. That it can affect reproduction of bird species, mm-hmm. for example. And there are a lot of things that can function as endocrine disruptors that aren't necessarily hormones, but mm-hmm. Are chemically similar to them, various steroids that may be part of the products. I don't know.
Antibiotics in the soil.
Yeah.
Perhaps
they would be metabolized by the time they went through their system.
I really don't know the answer to that.